gonna be way smaller. They say way warmer. It's always nice to be way warmer.
Galena residents rebuild more than a year after the devastating flood. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the invasive weed Elodea takes over lakes and rivers in Alaska.
It's almost like a disaster. You can't describe it until you see it. And then the next thing you say is, holy cow, how did that happen?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're having trouble taking medications or forgetting to take pills on time, there's help available for these serious common problems. Talk to your prescriber or pharmacist right away and visit meded.alaska.gov. There you'll find tips on safety, saving money, and more. When you take your medications as directed, you protect your health and independence. You protect your future. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The seismic storm in the far western arm of the Brooks Range that began nearly 2 months ago continued early this morning. Another magnitude 5.7 quake in the Noatak earthquake swarm struck just after 4 o'clock this morning. The Alaska Earthquake Center in Fairbanks says residents reported about a minute of strong shaking. The quake was located about 13 miles northeast of Noatak at a depth of 15 miles. A magnitude 4.2 shock preceded this morning's larger quake by just 1 minute. The Earthquake Center says it's expecting numerous aftershocks with magnitudes up to 4 in the coming hours. This morning's quake is the fifth such powerful shake since the earthquake swarm began April 18th with 2 5.7 quakes. In May, seismologists with the Earthquake Center installed field equipment in Noatak and Kotzebue to better monitor the activity. Despite the new equipment, seismologists say they still don't know what's causing the powerful shakes. With warm weather here, construction projects are getting underway across the state. In Galena, the sight of houses going up is particularly welcome. The 400-person village is still recovering from a catastrophic flood that occurred last year when the breakup of an ice jam caused the Yukon River to overflow. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports on the rebuilding effort.
It's a humid morning in Galena, and about a dozen workers are framing a house. They've been working at it for about 4 days, and already the place is taking shape. It's a big two-story building, with a wide footprint and space for at least 4 bedrooms. The goal is to finish the exterior work within a week. Decked in a red shirt and a camouflage cowboy hat, Doug Konecki is sawing away at wooden boards.
We are building rafters for this particular house. And it's really not that complicated. It's just a lot of little cuts.
Konecki is one of the hundreds of FEMA volunteers who will work on the construction effort in Galena this summer. He's from North Carolina, and he's part of a Christian relief effort called Samaritan's Purse. Konecki is working with a fellow Tar Heel named Hugh Honeycutt. Neither of them have been to Alaska before, let alone worked in the state. It's not really what they're accustomed to. For one, you can't drive to Home Depot if you need extra materials. And then there's the rain.
Down in the lower 48, if it rains, you take the day off. But here, if you take the day off, then you only have 4 days when you can build.
Or three, or two.
or two, right, exactly, exactly.
So they've gotten used to being damp.
Oh, absolutely.
Put on a raincoat and keep going.
Exactly.
The building process itself is also different. The house they're building is striking not just for its massive size. It also happens to sit on tall steel pilings elevated at least 5 feet off the ground. Konecki says he's never worked on anything like it.
Where I live, we build them up off the ground a little bit, but not on stilts like this.
The half a dozen houses that FEMA volunteers are building are raised like this. The flood came in hard and fast last year, swamping areas of town that should have been safe. So now, houses must be built above the high water mark to qualify for disaster relief.
Everything's up in the air.
Everything's up in the air. I mean, you have to lift everything up there. Every single piece, every single nail goes up.
Steve Settle is a Galena resident who qualified for one of these elevated FEMA houses. Construction of his new place is underway as well, and its frame also rests on pilings buried deep into the ground.
They told me 25 feet. So this is 4 feet or something higher.
Settle says the new place will be a change from his old one. On top of being built to survive a flood, it will also meet new cold climate housing standards with thicker walls and other features to make it airtight.
It's going to be way smaller. They say way warmer. But, it's always nice to be way warmer anyway, you know.
Settle has lived in Galena for 33 years, and he says the flooding of the Yukon River last April was like nothing he had ever seen.
They said it was just like a bathtub, pulling the plug and it just went out, you know.
Even though his property is fairly inland, Settle's home was basically destroyed.
Back of the house sloughed off.
The water nearly swept it away.
It moved his house. The only thing that was holding that house from floating off was the power line.
Settle says he lost a lot in the flood, but he's looking forward to moving into his new place this fall. Right now, he's trying to figure out where his windows will go.
It's going to be probably 4 or 5, you know, so it's going to be well lit. Mm-hmm. White walls probably, you know, so it'll probably really glow in there, you know.
And, he says, it should hopefully stay dry. In Galena, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The U.S. Department of Interior is asking for public comment on a new policy that will allow it to take land into trust for Alaska Native tribes. Alaska Native leaders say the change, after years of litigation, brings them one step closer to self-determination. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports from Bethel.
Trust status for tribal land protects it from taxation and alienation, the taking or sale of land, and gives tribes greater jurisdiction. Reservations are trust lands and are common throughout the lower 48. However, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, or ANCSA, transferred title to land to for-profit regional and village corporations, not to tribes. Then a Department of Interior Associate Solicitor issued an opinion in 1978 interpreting ANCSA to mean tribes should not be allowed to put lands into trust. Now, the courts say that's going to change due to a lawsuit filed by the villages of Akiachuk, Tuliksak, Chelkisak, and Chilkoot. That's good news, says Moses Peter from Tuliksak, upriver from Bethel.
Hallelujah. It's about time. I've been praying to the Secretary of Interior to put the non-ANCSA lands into trust. It's going to change the public policy.
Under the new rules, tribes could put lands they own into trust, including lands they'd purchased or received through an inheritance from a church, for example, or lands transferred to tribes by Native corporations. Mike Williams, Sr. from Akiak, says the rule change could help correct problems created by ANCSA.
For instance, you know, not managing our own lands as tribes, and our kids that were born after December 18, 1971 are treated differently, and they didn't have anything until I die, and then our hunting and fishing rights were extinguished.
Trust status basically gives tribes control over laws and management of the land, while restricting the power of the state. Proponents of the change hope it will improve public safety. The Indian Law and Order Commission recently recommended the prohibition be removed for that very reason. Supporters say it could also enhance tribes' ability to provide services, promote economic development, and exert regulatory authority in their communities. In short, provide an avenue for more local control. Noah Andrew Sr. from Tuliksak says that's what he wants.
I'd like it to be within the village council itself, not with the federal trust or state involved. Get it back to our traditional government. We do have established ways of doing things within our, and we've exercised them. It has been fought down generation after generation, and we've managed to co-manage things, and that's how we succeed.
Heather Kendall Miller is the attorney with the Native American Rights Fund who argued the original case of Akiyachuk versus Salazar on behalf of the four tribes and one individual, which led to the rule change. She's urging people to submit comments telling the Department of the Interior what the rule change would mean to them.
It's important for people to understand that this is an opportunity for them to come forward and to discuss with Assistant Secretary Washburn their unique circumstances and why they believe that given certain those circumstances, they may benefit from having lands taken into trust.
Still, it'll be a long process before land transfers can occur. The Department of Interior is accepting comments on the proposed rule change. Then the agency will develop a process for tribes to apply for trust status. Once an application is made, the department still has the authority to deny the transfer. Albert Kukesh, chairman of the board of Sea Lasca Corporation in Southeast, says he understands tribes are eager for the change.
I could understand why the tribes are looking at it and saying to all of their corporations that, and saying, let's do something different. How about you let us be the landowners? How about let us be the land operators? Let us be the land caretakers.
Kukesh says his corporation isn't making plans to transfer lands to tribes, but will consider it when the rule change is final. The state of Alaska intervened in the case in 2008, arguing the rule change would diminish its authority to tax tribal lands and to enforce regulations and undermine ANCSA, views the court did not uphold. In a written statement, Ann Nelson, the state's lead attorney on the case, says the state believes the rule change is premature because the state is appealing the district court judgment. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the story of a raven's tail robe a mother wove to honor her daughter.
Every time she wraps the robe around her, she is getting a hug from her family.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Finding the time for physical activity after school, homework, and dinner can be tough, but you can make it a priority to stay healthy as a family. Go for a bike ride, take a walk around the neighborhood, or play a game of basketball with your kids. Get active, get moving, and have fun as a family. Inspire your kids to get out and play 60 minutes every day. For more ways to get physically active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The state has reached tentative agreement on a new 3-year contract with the largest union representing Alaska Marine Highway System workers. The proposal includes a 1% pay raise starting July 1, 2015, and 2% the following year. It also calls for employees to pay $100 annually to use the ferry, a benefit the union's regional director says extends to immediate family. Previously, workers and retirees and their families received free passage on ferries on a standby basis. Terms must be approved by the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific and the state legislature. The agreement keeps in place the long-standing pay differential between in-state and out-of-state employees that lawmakers debated earlier this year. A Department of Administration spokesman says talks are continuing with the other two marine unions. Managers of the 100 Mile Creek wildfire response are bracing for high winds. The 23,000-acre fire west of Delta Junction could have south winds gusting to 35 miles per hour and humidity in the 25% range. More than 500 firefighters are assigned to the blaze, and Fire Information Officer Sarah Sarlows says a lot of work has been done.
The amount of firefighters that we've had in there the last week, they've been able to really establish some strong control lines on the north end of the fire. And with today's wind, it will test those lines, but the fire operations are feeling confident that those lines will hold.
The 100 Mile Creek fire is about 20 miles west of Delta Junction, but the scar from last summer's Mississippi wildfire is between it and the city. The Whitestone Farms community to the northeast is also buffered. Sarlo says much of the firefighters' work has been focused on protecting private properties on the fire's west side.
There are some recreational homes and cabins that we've been at and doing structure protection and structure assessment.
Sarlo says the work around the homes has been completed. For the past few years, Alaska has tried to eradicate a known invasive aquatic plant, Elodea. The sturdy weed has taken root in a handful of the state's water bodies, threatening native birds, fish, and fauna. As ocean temperatures increase and icy days decrease, researchers worry it's only a matter of time before Elodea and other invasive plants and animals spread throughout Alaska. APRN intern Joaquin Palomino has the story.
I'm standing with Tim Rydell on his porch overlooking the southern shore of Sand Lake in South Anchorage.
It looks like scum, really. I mean, that's the only way to... super thick scum.
Once relatively untouched, Elodea has taken over parts of the lake.
It's almost like a disaster. You can't describe it until you see it. And then the next thing you say is, holy cow, how did that happen?
Elodea is the only known invasive aquatic plant in Alaska. Since being discovered near Fairbanks in 2010, it has taken root in 15 of the state's rivers, lakes, and streams. Once established, the weed spreads quickly, crowding out spawning grounds for fish and killing off food sources for birds and other wildlife. Rydell says the plant can also be a pain in the neck for boaters and pilots.
It stops your boat. It's so thick. You have to stop and tilt the motor up and clear out the weeds and keep blasting until you finally get into open water.
To manage the invasion, the state issued a quarantine on the plant in March, meaning it's illegal to transport Elodea across Alaskan borders. But that's unlikely to stop its spread.
The lighter stemmed colored ones, that's a big mat of it right there.
Heather Stewart works for Alaska's Department of Natural Resources. We're on the central bank of Sand Lake now, searching for the weed. As she scans the water, she notes the half dozen float planes in view, one of the biggest transporters of Elodea.
Plane rudders can actually get caught up in that vegetation, and as soon as that plane takes off, the pilot has no control to get rid of it on those rudders.
Thus, spreading the problem. And with fewer icy days in Alaska's future, Stewart worries that planes could become a huge vector for the weed.
If there's less ice on the water or more ice-free days, oh, it's Alaska. More people are going to want to be out as long as possible while the weather's still good. So if you have that sort of mentality, there's going to be more plane activity.
Warmer weather won't only make it harder to curb Elodea. It could also prompt a sharp increase in other invasive species throughout Alaska. Changing conditions in the Arctic are particularly concerning.
Invasive species as a global issue have been tied closely to shipping.
Whitman Miller, a biologist at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, is monitoring changing sea ice conditions in the Arctic.
When invasion scientists see sort of a new corridor or a new pathway opening up by which different biota can be mixed, it always sends up a big alarm signal.
As more ships traverse the Arctic Passage, foreign plants and animals could be transported between the Atlantic and Pacific via the boat's holes and ballast waters. Back in Anchorage, Tim Rydell remembers what Sand Lake looked like before Elodea showed up.
I mean, I could stand on the porch and see fish, and you could see the bottom of the lake. And now all I can see is weeds and that super industrial thick scum on top.
Rydell isn't too concerned about the future of the Arctic. He's just waiting for the state to clean out the 85-acre lake in his backyard.
The ounce of prevention is worth the pound of cure. And in order to eradicate this weed, today's the day you need to do it because it's not going to get any cheaper. It's only going to get bigger and worse.
State and federal researchers are testing different herbicides in Kenai. Once the results are in, they'll look into eradicating the weed in Sand Lake. In Anchorage, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The biennial culture and dance festival Celebration ended Saturday night in Juneau with a grand exit. The festival, organized by Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, included performances, lectures, and language sessions. The juried art show features Della Cheney's Raven's Tail robe. When Cheney started weaving the robe in honor of her daughter's doctorate, she didn't realize she would go through her own big change. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Della Cheney started weaving her daughter's robe in early 2011. She had weaved about a quarter of it when she began to feel not right.
I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know. So I went to get my yearly test, and they found something abnormal.
Cheney was diagnosed with endometrial cancer. She stopped weaving and had to have surgery and chemotherapy. A year later, Cheney went back to the robe and started over. This meant undoing 14 inches of weaving, more than a year's worth of work. Cheney's daughter, Gail Cheney, explains why.
You don't want to have bad feelings in the robe. You don't want to be weaving while you're thinking bad things or in a bad place. So can you tell yourself, no, I want to start again? That's hard when you've gone down as far as she did when she took it back. In the midst of all her challenges, she held herself to a very high standard.
Gail was in the process of getting her PhD in leadership and change from Antioch University, a program focused on bringing about change in workplaces and communities. She was also the human resources director at Sea Alaska Corporation, a position she still holds. Her dissertation explored the future of Native values at an Alaska Native corporation. Gail says Sea Alaska has been working on integrating Native values at a corporate level for the past few years. She uses Ha'ani, meaning our land, as an example.
We have a sense of what Ha'ani means at a community level, subsistence, maintaining our resources. What does that mean at a corporate level? Perhaps it means figuring out sustainable uses, because we do need to use our land, but we need to use it in a way that it's there for our future generations and for everyone's use.
Cheney's challenge was to show change and leadership in her weaving.
So I chose to do the pattern called the flying geese pattern to show the change with the geese arriving in the spring and leaving in the fall, and how the leadership changes when they're flying in a flock. They take turns leading.
The robe shows three rows of geese changing direction, flying right and left, then right again. The prominent colors are red and white.
The red color shows the power of change, and the white color shows the integrity that needs to be followed in order for change to happen.
On the bottom of the robe is a block design that Cheney calls all of our ancestors. It's the foundation of the robe.
That's where our life started, was from our ancestors.
The block also represents loss.
We had four of our family members pass away with cancer in the time I started the robe to the end.
For Cheney, no evidence of cancer remains. She says weaving is a form of art therapy and helped her through the process of being okay again.
There's all that healing that goes on because of that long, repetitive movement that you have across the 60-inch robe. Going over and under, each row is a long ways across, maybe 45 minutes to get across. And what do you think about during that time besides the pattern? Really is a healing time.
On the top of the robe, Cheney weaved the words Cakes Kwan in big, bold letters, which is Tlingit for their home village of Cake. This was Gail's idea.
She has grown up with this love from our family in Cake. So every time she wraps the robe around her, she is getting a hug from her family.
After 7 years of studying, Gail received her PhD this past February and had the graduation ceremony in Cake to thank the community. It took her mother 3 years to finish the robe. In the final year, she brought the loom wherever she went. She weaved in Juneau and Cake and even brought it to Anchorage. Gail says the robe represents journeys they both finished.
When I look at this, I think, I'm done. I'm really done. You know, I still have a lot of work to do, but the piece that's kind of been nagging at me for 7 years. The weight's gone. So, yeah, it's nice to see it finished. I think she feels the same. Oh, thank God I'm done.
Cheney says the robe will outlive both of them. In 500 years, the robe will continue to tell their woven stories of leadership and change. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
A British kayak team that's paddling along the Aleutian Islands reached Unalaska Sunday night. KUCB's Annie Ropeek joined the group that rowed out to meet them and has this story.
Since they set out from Adak in May, Sarah Uten and her kayaking partner Justine Kergenven have had plenty of warm welcomes in Aleutian villages, but...
No one's ever been out to kayak to meet us. You guys are top right. In their respect. Yeah.
A group of Unalaskans in kayaks met up with the adventurers in Unalaska Bay on Sunday night. The pair's last village stopover was in Nikolski more than a week ago. Since then, they've been rowing and camping their way east on their own.
It's been 8 days from Nikolski, which is quicker
which day
than we...
is it today?
This is day 8.
Is it Sunday?
Sunday.
Yeah. We left, last Sunday.
Yeah, so that was quicker than we expected, but we were lucky with the weather, so we haven't had a day off. Normally, we would have one, we'd expect to have a few days off because of the weather.
And they were greeted by more than just people on their way in toward Unalaska.
When we came around the corner to see the bay, it was just flat calm. The sun was out. The mountains were all beautiful. It was amazing. And then Sarah was like, there's a whale! And we watched two whales. She saw it breach. I missed it, but...
And then we had sea lions kind of escort us in for a bit as well. They were braver than the ones we've met out further on, so that was fun.
The team was tired and hungry, but dry land, showers, and beds were just a few minutes away, meaning Uten had time to stand up in her boat and snap a selfie of the whole group.
Now I'm going to try and get in it.
So if I do this...
Uten is rowing and biking her way all around the world. She and Kergenven will rest in Unalaska for a few days before continuing on their way to Homer. From there, Uten will bike across Canada, aiming to reach Nova Scotia by next March. In Unalaska Bay, I'm Annie Ropeek.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Galena and Joaquin Palomino from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.